This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Chapter 11 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 11. It was the end of August. The little lawn at Slumberley Rectory was parched and brown. The glebe beyond was brown, so was the field beyond that. The Firsty Road was ash-white between its grey hedgerows. It was hotter in the open air than in the house, but Ruth had brought her books out into the garden all the same, and had made a conscientious effort to read under the chestnut tree. For under the same roof with Mrs. Alwyn, she had soon learned that application or study of any kind was an impossibility. Mrs. Alwyn had several maxims as to the conduct of herself, and consequently of everyone else, and one of those to which she most frequently gave utterance was that young people should always be cheery and sociable, and should not be left too much to themselves. When in the winter Mr. Alwyn had brought home Ruth, quite overwhelmed for the time by the shock of the first real trouble she had known, Mrs. Alwyn was kindness itself in the way of sweetbreads and warm rooms. But the only thing Ruth craved for, to be left alone, she would not allow for a moment. No, Mrs. Alwyn was cheerful, brisk, and pious at intervals. If she found her niece was sitting in her own room, she bustled upstairs, poked the fire, gave her a kiss, and finally brought her down to the drawing-room, where she told her she would be as quiet as if in her own room. She'd not be afraid her uncle would come in, and she must not allow herself to get moped. What would she, Mrs. Alwyn, have done, she would like to know, if, when she was in trouble, and she knew what trouble meant if anyone did, she'd allowed herself to get moped? Ruth must try and bear up. And at Lady Dacourt's age it was quite to be expected, and Ruth must remember she still had a sister, and that there was a happy home above. And now, if she would get that green wool out of the red plush iron, which really was a workbox, such a droll idea, wasn't it, Ruth should hold the wool, and they would have a cosy little chat till luncheon-time. And so Mrs. Alwyn did her duty by her niece, and Ruth, in the dark days that followed her grandmother's death, took all the little kindnesses in the spirit in which they were meant, and did her duty by her aunt. But after a time Mrs. Alwyn became more exacting. Ruth was visibly recovering from what Mrs. Alwyn called her bereavement. She could smile again without an effort. She took long walks with Mr. Alwyn, and later in the spring paid a visit to her uncle, Lord Polesworth. It was after this visit that Mrs. Alwyn became more exacting. She had borne with half attention and a lack of interest in crewel work while Ruth was still fretting, as she termed it. But when a person lays aside crape and goes into half-mourning, the time had come when she may, nay, when she ought, to be chatty. This time had come with Ruth, but she was not chatty. Like Mrs. Dombey, she did not make an effort. And as the month passed on, Mrs. Alwyn began to shake her head and to fear that there was some officer or something on her mind. Mrs. Alwyn always called soldiers officers and doctors physicians. Ruth, on her side, was vaguely aware that she did not give satisfaction. The small talk, the perpetual demand on her attention, the constant interruptions, seemed to benumb what faculties she had. Her mind became like a machine out of work, rusty, creaking, difficult to set going. If she had half an hour of leisure, she could not fix her attention to anything. She, who in her grandmother's time had been so keen and alert, seemed to have drifted, in Mrs. Alwyn's society, into a torpid state, from which she made vain attempts to emerge, only to sink the deeper. When she stood once more, fresh from a fortnight of pleasant intercourse with pleasant people, in the little ornate drawing-room at Slumberley, on her return from Atherston, The remembrance of the dulled, confused state in which she had been living with her aunt returned forcibly to her mind. The various articles of furniture, the red silk handkerchiefs dabbed behind pendant plates, the musical elephants on the mantelpiece, the imitation Eastern antimacassars, the shocking fate in the way of nailed and glued pictorial ornamentation that had overtaken the back of the cottage piano, indeed, all the various objects of luxury and vertu with which Mrs. Alwyn had surrounded herself, seemed to recall to Ruth, as the apparatus of the sick-room recalls the illness to the patient, the stupor into which she had fallen in their company. With her eyes fixed upon the new brass pig, that was at heart a penwiper, which Mrs. Alwyn had pointed out as a gift of Mabel Thursby, who always brought her back some little tasty thing from London, with her eyes on the brass pig, Ruth resolved that, come what would, she would not allow herself to sink into such a state of mental paralysis again. To read a book of any description was out of the question in the society of Mrs. Alwyn. But Ruth, with the connivance of Mr. Alwyn, devised a means of eluding her aunt. At certain hours of the day she was lost regularly, and not to be found. It was summer, and the world, or at least the neighbourhood of Slumberly Rectory, which was the same thing, was all before her where to choose. In after years she used to say that some books had always remained associated with certain places in her mind. With Emerson she learned to associate the scent of hay, the desultory remarks of hens, and the sudden choruses of ducks. Carlyle's Sartor Resartus, which she read for the first time this year, always recalled to her afterwards the leathern odour of the box-room, with an occasional soupçon of damp flapping linen in the orchard, which spot was not visible from the rectory windows. Gradually Mrs. Alwyn became aware of the fact that Ruth was never to be seen with a book in her hand, and she expressed fears that the latter was not keeping up her reading. "And if you don't like to read to yourself, my dear, you can read to me while I work. German, now. I like the sound of German very well. It brings back the time when your Uncle John and I went up the Rhine on our honeymoon. And then, for English reading, there's a very nice book Uncle John has somewhere on natural history called Animals of a Quiet Life by Mr. Hare, too. So comical, I always think. It's good for you to be reading something. It is what your poor dear granny would have wished if she had been alive. Only it must not be poetry, Ruth, not poetry." Mrs. Alwyn did not approve of poetry. She was wont to say that for her part she liked only what was perfectly true, for which it is believed she meant prose. She had no books of her own. In times of illness she borrowed from Mrs. Thursby, but all Miss Young's works, and selections from the publications of the SPCK. On Sundays, when she could not work, she read, half aloud, of course, with sighs at intervals, a little manual called Gold Dust, or a smaller one still called Pearls of Great Price, which she at once recommended to Charles, whom she knew slightly, and about whom she affected to know a great deal, which nothing, except pressing, would induce her to repeat, which rendered the application of the pearls to be followed by the dust most essential to his future welfare. On this particular morning in August, Ruth had slipped out as far as the chestnut tree, the lower part of which was hidden from the rectory windows by a blessed yew hedge. It was too hot to walk, it was too hot to draw, it was even too hot to read. It did not seem, however, to be too hot to ride. Presently she heard a horse's hoofs clattering across the stones of the stable yard, and she knew, from the familiarity of the sound at that hour of the day, that Dare had probably ridden over, and more probably still, would stay to luncheon. The foreign gentleman, as all the village people called him, had by this time become quite an institution in the neighbourhood of Vanden. Everyone liked him, and he liked everyone. Like the sun, he shone upon the just and unjust. He went to every tennis party to which he was invited. He was pleased if people were at home when he called. He became in many houses a privileged person, and he never abused his privileges. Women especially liked him. He had what Mrs. Eccles defined as such a way with him, his way being to make every woman he met think that she was particularly interesting in his eyes, for the time being. Men did not, of course, care for him so much. When he stayed anywhere, it was vaguely felt by the sterner sex of the party that he stole a march upon them. While they were smoking, after their kind, in clusters on the lawn, it would suddenly be observed that he was sitting in the drawing-room, giving a lesson in netting, or trying over a new song, encircled by young ladyhood. It was felt that he took an unfair advantage. What business has he to come to tea in that absurd amber plush smoking suit just because the elder ladies have begged to see it? It was all the more annoying because he looked so handsome in it. Like most men who are admired by women, he was not much liked by men. But the house to which he came the oftenest was Slumberly Rectory. He was faithful to his early admiration of Ruth, and the only obstacle to his making her, in his opinion, happy among women, namely her possible want of fortune, had long since been removed by the confidential remarks of Mrs. Alwyn. To his foreign habits and ideas, 1400 or 1500 a year represented a very large sum. In his eyes, Ruth was an heiress, and in all good earnest he set himself to win her. Mr. Alwyn had now become the proper person to consult regarding his property, and at first, to Ruth's undisguised satisfaction, he consulted him nearly every other day, his horse at last taking the turn for Slumberly as a matter of course. Many a time, in these August days, might Mrs. Eccles and all the other inhabitants of Slumberly have seen Dare ride up the little street, taking as much active exercise as his horse, only skyward, the saddle being to him merely a point of rebound. But if the object of his frequent visits was misunderstood by Ruth at first, Dare did not allow it to remain so long. And not only Ruth herself, but Mr. and Mrs. Alwyn, and the rectory servants, and half the parish, were soon made aware of the state of his affections. What was the good of being in love, of having in view a social aim of such a praiseworthy nature, if no one were aware of the same? Dare was not the man to hide even a nightlight under a bushel, how much less a burning and a shining hymeneal torch such as this. His sentiments were strictly honourable. If he raised expectations, he was also quite prepared to fulfil them. Miss Dacourt was quite right to treat him with her adorable, placid assumption of indifference until his attentions were more avowed. In the meanwhile, she was an angel, a lily, a pearl, a star, and several other things, animal, vegetable, and mineral, which his vivid imagination chose to picture her. But whatever Dare's faults may have been, and Ruth was not blind to them, he was at least head over ears in love with her, fortune or none. And as his attachment deepened, it burned up like fire all the little follies with which it had begun. A clergyman has been said to have made love to the helpmeet of his choice out of the Epistle to the Galatians. Dare made his out of material hardly more promising, plans for cottages and estimates of repairs. He quickly seen how to interest Ruth, though the reason for such an eccentric interest puzzled him. However, he turned it to his advantage. Ruth encouraged, suggested, sympathised in all the little he was already doing, and the much that he proposed to do. Of late, however, a certain not ungrounded suspicion had gradually forced itself upon her, which had led her to withdraw as much as she could from her former intercourse with Dare. But her change of manner had not quite the effect she had intended. "She thinks I'm not serious," Dare had said to himself. "She thinks that I play with her feelings. She doesn't know me. Tomorrow I ride over. I set her mind at rest. Tomorrow I propose. I make an offer. I claim that adored hand. I become engaged." Accordingly, not long after the clatter of horses' hoofs in the stable-yard, Dare himself appeared in the garden, and, perceiving Ruth, for whom he was evidently looking, informed her that he had ridden over to ask Mr. Alwyn to support him at a dinner his tenants were giving in his honour, a custom of the Vanden tenantry from time immemorial on the accession of a new landlord. He spoke absently, and Ruth, looking at him more closely as he stood before her, wondered at his altered manner. He had a rose in his buttonhole. He always had a rose in his buttonhole, but somehow this was more of a rose than usual. His moustaches were twirled up with unusual grace. "You will find Mr. Alwyn in the study," said Ruth hurriedly. His only answer was to cast aside his whip and gloves as possible impediments later on, and to settle himself, with an elegant arrangement of the choicest gaiters, on the grass at her feet. It is probably very disagreeable to repeat in any form, however discreetly worded, the old phrase, "The reason why I cannot tell, but I don't like you, Dr. Fell." But it must be especially disagreeable, if a refusal at first not taken seriously, to be obliged to repeat it still more plainly a second time. It was Ruth's fate to be obliged to do this, and to do it hurriedly, or she foresaw complications might arise. At last Dare understood, and the sudden utter blankness of his expression smote Ruth to the heart. He had loved her in his way, after all. It's a bitter thing to be refused. She felt that she had been almost brutal in her direct explicitness, called forth at the moment by an instinct that he would proceed to extreme measures unless peremptorily checked. "I'm so sorry," she said involuntarily. Poor Dare, who had recovered a certain amount of self-possession, now that he was on his feet again, took up his gloves and riding-whip in silence. All his jaunty self-assurance had left him. He seemed quite stunned. His face under his brown skin was very pale. "I'm so sorry," said Ruth again, feeling horribly guilty. "It is I who am sorry," he said humbly. "I've made a great mistake, for which I ask pardon." And, after looking at her for a moment, in blank incertitude as to whether she could really be the same person whom he had come to seek in such happy confidence half an hour before, he raised his hat, his new light grey hat, and was gone. Ruth watched him go. When he had disappeared, she sat down again mechanically in the chair from which he had risen a few moments before, and pressed her hands tightly together. "She ought not to have allowed such a thing to happen," she said to herself. "Somehow it had never presented itself to her in its serious aspect before. It is difficult to take a vain man seriously. Poor Mr. Dare! She had not known he was capable of caring so much about anything. He never appeared to such advantage in her eyes as he had done when he had left her the moment before, grave and silent. She felt she had misjudged him. He was not so frivolous after all. And now that her influence was at an end, who would keep him up to the mark about the various duties which she knew now he had begun to fulfil only to please her? Oh, who would help and encourage him in that most difficult of positions, a landowner without means sufficient for doing the best by land and tenantry? She instinctively felt that he could not be relied upon for continuous exertion by himself. "I wish I could have liked him," said Ruth to herself. I wish I could." End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 12. During the whole of the following week, Dare appeared no more at Stumperley. Mrs. Alwyn, whose time was much occupied, as a rule, in commenting on the smallest doings of her neighbours, and in wondering why they left undone certain actions which she herself would have performed in their place, Mrs. Alwyn would infallibly have remarked upon his absence many times during every hour of the day, had not her attention been distracted for the time being by a one-horse fly which she had seen go up the road on the afternoon of the day of Dare's last visit, the destination of which had filled her soul with anxious conjecture. She did not ascertain till the following day that it had been ordered for Mrs. Smith of Greenacre, though, as she told Ruth, she might have known that, as Mr. Smith was going for a holiday with Mrs. Smith and their pony lame in its feet, that they would have to have a fly, and with that hill up to Greenacre, she was surprised one horse was enough. When the question of the fly had been thus satisfactorily settled, and Mrs. Alwyn had ceased wondering whether the Smiths had gone to Tenby or to Rill, she always imagined people went to one or other of these two places, her whole attention reverted to a screen which she was making, the elegance and novelty of which supplied her with a congenial subject of conversation for many days. "There's something so new in a screen, an entire screen of Christmas cards," Mrs. Alwyn would remark. "Now, Mrs. Thursby's new screen is all pictures out of the Graphic, and those coloured Christmas numbers. She has put all her cards in a book. There's something rather passé about these albums, I think. Now, I fancy this screen will look quite out of the common, Ruth, and when it is done I shall get some of those Japanese cranes and stand them on the top. Their claws are made to twist round, you know, and I shall put some monkeys, you know, those droll chenille monkeys, Ruth, creeping up the sides to meet the cranes. I don't honestly think, my dear," with complacency, "that many people have anything like it." Ruth did not hesitate to say that she felt certain very few would. Mrs. Alwyn was delighted at the interest she took in her new work. Ruth was coming out at last, she told her husband, and she passed many happy hours entirely absorbed in the arrangements of the cards upon the panels. Ruth, thankful that her attention had providentially been distracted from the matter that filled her own thoughts in a way that surprised and annoyed her, sorted and snipped and pasted, and decided weighty questions as to whether a goitered robin on a twig should be placed next to a smiling plum pudding, dancing a polka with a turkey, or whether a congealed cross with Christian greeting in icicles on it should separate the two. To her uncle, Ruth told what had happened, and as he slowly wended his way to Vanden on the day fixed for the tenants' dinner, Mr. Irwin mused thereon, and I believe, if the truth were known, he was sorry that Dare had been refused. He was a little before his time, and he stopped on the bridge and looked at the river as it came churning and sweeping below, fretted out of its usual calm by the mill above. I think that as he leaned over the low stone parapet, he made many quiet little reflections beside the involuntary one of himself in the water below. He would have liked, he was conscious that it was selfish, but yet he would have liked, to have Ruth near him always. He would have liked to see this strange son of his old friend in good hands that would lead him, as it is popularly supposed a woman's hand sometimes can, in the way of all others in which Mr. Irwin was anxious that he should walk, a way in which he sometimes feared that Dear had not made any great progress as yet. Mr. Irwin felt at times, when conversing with him, that Dare's life could not have been one in which the nobler feelings of his nature had been much brought into play, so crude and unformed were his ideas of principle and responsibility, so slack and easy-going his views of life. But if Mr. Irwin felt an occasional twinge of anxiety and misgiving about his young friend, it speedily turned to self-upbraiding for indulging in a cynical, unworthy spirit, which was ever ready to seek out the evil and overlook the good. And he gradually convinced himself that only favourable circumstances were required for the blossoming forth of those noble attributes, of which the faintest indications on Dare's part were speedily magnified by the powerful lens of Mr. Irwin's charity, to an extent which would have filled Dare with satisfaction, and would have overwhelmed a more humble nature with shame. And Ruth would not have him. Mr. Irwin remembered a certain passage in his own youth, a long time ago, when somebody, a very foolish somebody, I think, would not have him either. And it was with that remembrance still in his mind that he met Dare, who had come as far as the lodge gates to meet him, and whose forlorn appearance touched Mr. Irwin's heart the moment he saw him. There was not time for much conversation. To his astonishment, Mr. Irwin found Dare actually nervous about the coming ordeal, and on the way to the Green Dragon, where the dinner was to be given, he reassured him as best he could, and suggested the kind of answer he should make when his health was drunk. When, a couple of hours later, all was satisfactorily over, when the last health had been drunk, the last song sung, and Dare was driving Mr. Irwin home in the shabby old Vanden dog-cart, both men were at first too much overcome by the fumes of tobacco in which they had been hidden to say a word to each other. At last, however, Mr. Irwin drew a long breath and said faintly, "I trust I may never be so hot again. Drive slowly under those trees, Dare. It is cooling to look at them after sitting behind that steaming volcano of a turkey. How is your head going on? I saw you went in for punch." "Was that punch?" said Dare. "Then I take no more punch in the future." "You spoke capitally, and brought in the right sentiment, that there is no place like home, in first-rate style. You see, you need not have been nervous." "Ah, but it was you who spoke really well," said Dare, with something of his old eager manner. "You know these people, you know their heart, you understand them. Now for me, I said what you tell me, and they were pleased, but I can never be with them like you. I understand the words they speak, but themselves I do not understand." "It will come." "No," with a rare accession of humility. "I have cared for none of these things till I came to hear them spoken of at Slumberley by you. And now at first it is smooth, because I say I will do what I can, but soon they will find out I cannot do much, and then—" He shrugged his shoulders. They drove on in silence. "But these things are nothing, nothing," burst out Dare at last in a tremulous voice, "to the one thing I think of all night, all day, how I love Miss Daincourt, and how—" with a simplicity which touched Mr. Irwin, "she does not love me at all." There is something pathetic in seeing any cheerful, light-headed animal reduced to silence and depression. To watch a barking, worrying, jovial puppy suddenly desist from parachute expeditions on unsteady legs, and from shaking imaginary rats, and creep, tail close at home, overcome by affliction, into obscurity, is a sad sight. Mr. Irwin felt much the same kind of pity for Dare as he glanced at him, resignedly blighted, handsomely forlorn, who but a short time ago had taken life as gaily and easily as a boy home for the holidays. "Sometimes," said Mr. Irwin, addressing himself to the mill and the bridge and the world in general, "young people change their minds. I've known such things happen." "I shall never change mine."
Perhaps not, but others might."
"Ah," then Dare turned sharply towards Mr. Irwin, scanning his face with sudden eagerness.
You think, possibly—"
"I don't think anything at all," interposed Mr. Irwin, rather taken aback at the evident impression his vague words had made, and anxious to qualify them.
"I was only speaking generally, but there is one point, as we are on the subject, that—"
"Yes, yes."
"Whether you consider any decision as final or not,"
Mr. Irwin addressed the clouds in the sky,
"I think, if you do not wish it to be known that anything has taken place, you'd better come and see me occasionally at Slumberley. I have missed your visits for the past week. The fact is, Mrs. Irwin has a way of interesting herself in all her friends. She has a kind heart, and, you understand, any little difference in their behaviour might be observed by her and might possibly,
Mr. Irwin was at a loss for a word,
"be, in short, commented on to others. Suppose now you were to come back with me to tea today."
And Dare went, nothing loath, and arrived at a critical moment in the manufacture of the screen, when all the thickest Christmas cards threatened to resist the influence of paste and to curl up, to the great anxiety of Mrs. Irwin. One of the principal reasons of Dare's popularity was the way in which he threw his whole heart into whatever he was doing for the time. Never for a long time, certainly, for he rarely bored himself or others by adherence to one set of ideas after its novelty had worn off. And now, as if nothing else existed in the world, and with a grave manner suggesting repressed suffering and manly resignation, he concentrated his whole mind on Mrs. Irwin's recalcitrant cards, and made Ruth grateful to him by his tact in devoting himself to her aunt and the screen.
"Well, I never," said Mrs. Irwin, after he was gone. "I never did see anyone like Mr. Dare. I declare he has made the church stick, Ruth, and blessings on my friend, which turned up at the corners twice when you put it on, and the big middle one of the kitten skating, too. Dear me, I am pleased. I hope Mrs. Thursby won't call till it's finished. But he did not look well, Ruth, did he? Rather pale now, I thought."
"He's had a tiring day," said Ruth.
End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 13. At Slumberley you have time to notice the change of the seasons. There's no hurry at Slumberley. Spring, summer, autumn and winter, each in their turn, take quite a year to come and go. 3 months ago it was August. Now September had arrived. It was actually the time of damsons. Those damsons which Ruth had seen dangling for at least 3 years in the cottage orchards were ripe at last. It seemed ages ago since April, when the village was a foaming mass of damson blossom, and the plum winter had set in just when spring really seemed to have arrived for good. It was a well-known thing in Slumberley, though Ruth, till last April, had not been aware of it, that God Almighty always sent cold weather when the Slumberley damsons were in bloom, to harden the fruit. And now the lame, the halt, and the aged of Slumberley, all with one consent, mounted on tottering ladders to pick these damsons, or that mysterious fruit closely akin to the same, called black lammas plumes. There were plum accidents, of course, in plenty. The Lord took Mrs. Eccles' own uncle from his half-filled basket to another world, for which, as a tea and coffee teetotaler, he was no doubt well prepared. The two receptive organisms of unsuspecting infancy suffered in their turn. In short, it was a busy season for Mr. and Mrs. Irwin. Ruth had plenty of opportunities now for making her long-projected sketch of the ruined house of Arley, but the old woman who lived in the lodge close by, and had charge of the place, had ricked her back in a damson tree, and Ruth often went to see her.
She had been Ruth's nurse in her childhood, and having originally come from Snubberley, returned there when the Danecourt children grew up, and lived happily ever after with the very blind and entirely deaf old husband of her choice in the grey stone lodge at Arley. It was on her return from one of these almost daily visits that Mrs. Eccles pounced on Ruth as she passed her gate, and under pretence of inquiring after Mrs. Cotton, informed her that she herself was suffering in no slight degree. Ruth, who suddenly remembered that she had been remiss in dropping in on Mrs. Eccles of late, dropped in then and there to make up for past delinquencies. "Is it rheumatism again?" she asked, as Mrs. Eccles seemed inclined to run off at once into a report of the goings-on of Widow Jones's Sally.
"Not that, my dear, so much as a sinking," said Mrs. Eccles, passing her hand slowly over what seemed more like a rising than a depression in her ample figure. "But there, I've not been myself since the Lord took old Samuel Price, and that's the truth."
Samuel Price was the relation who had entered into rest off a ladder, and Ruth looked duly serious. "I have no doubt it upset you very much," she said.
"Well, miss," returned Mrs. Eccles with dignity, "it's not as if I had me health before. I've had something wrong in the system."
Ruth wondered whether she meant system.
"These many years. From a gale I suffered in my inside. But lo, I was born to trouble, baptised in a bucket, and taken with colics at a week old. And how did you say Mrs. Cotton of the Lodge might be, miss, as I hear is but poorly too?"
Ruth replied that she was better.
"She's no size to keep her in health," said Mrs. Eccles, "and so bent as she does grow, to be sure. Hey, dear, but it's a good thing to be tall. I always think little folks, they're like them little watches. There's no room for their insides. And I wonder now..."
Mrs. Eccles was coming to the point that had made her entrap Ruth on her way past.
"I wonder now..."
Ruth did not help her. She knew too well the universal desire for knowledge of good and evil peculiar to her sex to doubt for a moment that Mrs. Eccles had begged her to step in only to obtain some piece of information about which her curiosity had been aroused.
"I wonder now if Cotton at the Lodge has heard anything of the poachers again this year, round Arkley way."
"Not that I know of," said Ruth, surprised at the simplicity of the question.
"Dear sakes, and to think of him at Vanden last night, and Mr. Dare and the keepers out all night after him."
Ruth was interested in spite of herself.
"And the doctor sent for in the middle of the night," continued Mrs. Eccles,
covertly eyeing Ruth.
"Poor young gentleman, for all his foreign ways, so many in Vanden have set store by him."
"I don't think you need to be uneasy about Mr. Dare," said Ruth coldly, conscious that Mrs. Eccles was dying to see her change colour. "If anything had happened to him, Mr. Alwyn would have heard of it. And now," rising, "I must be going. If I were you, Mrs. Eccles, I should not listen to all the gossip of the village."
"Me listen?" said Mrs. Eccles, much offended. "Me, as is too poorly so much as to put my foot out of the door? But, dear heart," with her usual quickness of vision, "if there isn't Mr. Alwyn and Dr. Brown riding up that street now in Dr. Brown's gig. Well, I never! And Mr. Alwyn is a-getting out, and a-talking as grave as can be to Dr. Brown. Poor Mr. Dare! Poor dear young gentleman!"
Ruth was conscious that she beat rather a hurried retreat from Mrs. Eccles' cottage, and that her voice was not quite so steady as usual when she asked the doctor if it were true that Mr. Dare had been hurt.
"All the village will have it that he is killed, but he's all right, I assure you, Miss Danecourt," said the kind old doctor, so soothingly and reassuringly that Ruth grew pink with annoyance at the tone.
"Not a scratch. He was out with his keepers last night, and they had a brush with poachers, and Martin, the head keeper, was shot in the leg. Bled a good deal, so they sent for me. But no danger. I picked up your uncle here on his way to see him, and so I gave him a lift there and back. That's all, I assure you."
Dr. Brown and Mrs. Eccles, straining over her geraniums, both came to the same conclusion, namely that, as Mrs. Eccles elegantly expressed it,
"Miss Ruth wanted Mr. Dare."
"And you'll have her too, I'm thinking, one of these days," Mrs. Eccles would remark to the circle of her acquaintance.
Indeed, the match was discussed on numerous ladders, with almost as much interest as the unfailing theme of the Damsons themselves. Adair rode over to the rectory as often as he used to do before a certain day in August, when he found Ruth under the chestnut tree. The very day before Mrs. Alwyn started on her screen, now the completed glory of the drawing-room. And was Ruth beginning to like him? as it had not occurred to her to ask herself that question. I suppose she was not. Dare had grown very quiet and silent of late, and showed a growing tendency to dark hats. His refusal had been so unexpected that the blow, when it came, fell with all the more crushing force. His self-love and self-esteem had been wounded, but so had something else. Under the velvet corduroy waistcoat, which he wore in imitation of Ralph, he had a heart. Whether it was one of the very best of its kind, or warranted to wear well, is not for us to judge. But at any rate, it was large enough to take in a very real affection, and to feel a very sharp pang. Dare's manner to Ruth was now as diffident as it had formerly been assured. To some minds there is nothing more touching than a sudden access of humility on the part of a vain man. Whether Ruth's mind was one of this class or not, we do not pretend to know. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 14. It was Sunday morning at Atherston. In the dining room, breakfasting alone, for he had come down late, was Sir Charles Danvers. His sudden arrival on the previous Saturday was easily accounted for. When he had casually walked into the drawing-room late in the evening, he had immediately and thoroughly explained the reasons of his unexpected arrival. It seemed odd that he should have come to Atherston, in the Midland Counties, on his way between two shooting visits in the north, but so it was. It might have been thought that one of his friends would have been willing to keep him 2 days longer, or receive him 2 days earlier, but no doubt everyone knows his own affairs best, and Charles might certainly, at his age, as he was so fond of saying, be expected to know his. Anyhow, there he was, leaning against the open window, coffee cup in hand, lazily watching the dwindling figures of Ralph and Evelyn, with Molly between them, disappearing in the direction of Greenacre Church, hard by. The morning mist still lingered on the land, and veiled the distance with a tender blue. And up across the silver fields and across the standing armies of the yellowing corn, the sound of church bells came from Slumberley, beyond the river, bringing back to Charles, as to us all, old memories, old hopes, old visions of early youth, long cherished, long forgotten. The single bell of Greenacre was giving forth a slow, persistent, cracked invitation to true believers as an appropriate prelude to Mr. Smith's eloquence, but Charles did not hear its testimony. He was listening to the Slumberley bells. Was that the first chime or the second? Suddenly a thought crossed his mind. Should he go to church? He smiled at the idea. It was a little late to think of that. Besides, he had let the others start, and he disliked that refuge of mildew and dust, Greenacre. There was Slumberley. There went the bells again. Slumberley? Absurd! Why, he should positively have to run to get there before the first lesson. That mist meant heat, or he was much mistaken. Charles contemplated the mist for a few seconds. Tang, teng, ting, tong, tong. He certainly always made a point of going to church at his own home. A good example is, after all, just as important in one place as another. Tang, tong, ten, tong, ting, went the bells. Why not run? Suggested an inner voice. Put down your cup. There, now, your hat's in the hall, with your gloves beside it. Never mind about your prayer book. Dear me, don't waste time looking for your own stick. Take any. Quick, out through the garden gate. No one can see you. The servants have all gone to church except the cook, and the kitchen looks out on the yew hedge. Over the first stile, said Charles to himself. I'm out of sight of the house now. Let us be thankful for small mercies. I shall do it yet. What a fool I am. I'm worse than Racker, as Molly said. I shall be rushing precipitately down a steep place into the sea next. Confound this gate. Why can't people leave them open? At any rate, it will remain open now. I'm not going to have my devotions curtailed by a gate. I fancied it would be hot, but nothing, anything half as hot as this. Hope I shan't meet Brown taking a morning stroll. I value Brown, but I should have to dismiss him if he saw me now. I could never meet his eye again. What on earth shall I say to Ralph and Evelyn when I get back? What a merciful providence it is that Aunt Mary's at this moment intoning a response in the highest church in Scarborough. Ting, ting, ting. Mr. Elwin's getting on his surplice, is he? Well, and if he is, I can make a final rush through the corn, can't I? There's not a creature in sight. The bell's down. What of that? There's the voluntary. Easy over the last fields. There are houses inside, and there may be wicked Sabbath-breakers looking out of the windows. Brown's foal has grown since July. Here we are. I'm not the only Christian hurrying along the tombs. I shall get in with the wicked man, after all.
Some people do not look round in church. Others do.
Mrs. Alwyn always did, partly because she wished to see what was going on behind her, and partly because, in turning back again, she could take a stealthy survey of Mrs. Thursby's bonnet, in which she always felt a burning interest, which she would not for worlds have allowed that lady to suspect. If the turning round had been all, it would have mattered little, but Mrs. Alwyn suffered so intensely from keeping silence that she was obliged to relieve herself at intervals by short whispered comments to Ruth. On this particular morning, it seemed as if the comments would never end.
"I'm so glad we asked Mr. Dare into our pew, Ruth. The Thursbys are full. That's Mrs. Thursby's sister in the red bonnet."
Ruth made no reply. She was following the responses in the Psalms with a marked attention, purposely marked to check conversation, and sufficient to have daunted anybody but her aunt. Mrs. Alwyn took a spasmodic interest in the psalm, but it did not last.
"Only two basses in the choir, and the new Te Deum, Ruth. How vexed Mr. Alwyn will be!"
No response from Ruth. Mrs. Alwyn took another turn at her prayer book, and then at the congregation.
"I am become as it were a monster unto Ruth, Ruth!"
Ruth at last turned her head a quarter of an inch.
"Sir Charles Danvers is sitting in the free seats by the font!"
Ruth nailed her eyes to her book, and would vouchsafe no further sign of attention during the rest of the service. And there, on the other side, anxious to copy Ruth in everything, being equally obdurate, Mrs. Alwyn had no resource left but to follow the service half aloud to herself, at the times when the congregation was not supposed to join in, putting great emphasis on certain words which she felt applicable to herself, in a manner that effectually prevented anyone near her from attending to the service at all. It was with a sudden pang that Dare, following Ruth out into the sunshine after service, perceived for the first time Charles, standing, tall and distinguished-looking, beside the rather insignificant heir of all the Thursbys, who regarded him with the mixed admiration and gnawing envy of a very young man for a man no longer young. And then, Charles never quite knew how it happened, but with the full intention of walking back to the rectory with the Alwyns and staying to luncheon, he actually found himself in Ruth's very presence, accepting a cordial invitation to luncheon at Slumberley Hall. For the first time during the last 10 years he had done a thing he had no intention of doing. A temporary long-lost feeling of shyness had seized upon him as he saw Ruth coming out, tall and pale and graceful, from the shadow of the church porch into the blaze of the midday sunshine. He had not calculated either for that sudden disconcerting leap of the heart as her eyes met his. He had an idiotic feeling that she must be aware that he had run most of the way to church, and that he had contemplated the burnished circles of her back hair for 2 hours, without a glance at the fashionably scraped-up headdress of Mabel Thursby, with its hogged mane of little wire curls in the nape of the neck. He felt he still looked hot and dusty, though he had imagined he was quite cool the moment before. To his own astonishment he actually found his self-possession leaving him, and though its desertion proved only momentary, in that moment he found himself walking away with the Thursbys in the direction of the hall. He was provoked, angry with himself, with the Thursbys, and most of all with Mr. Alwyn, who had come up a second later and asked him to luncheon as a matter of course. Also Dare, who accepted with evident gratitude. Charles felt that he had not gone steeplechasing over the country only to talk to Mrs. Thursby, and to see Ruth stroll away over the fields with Dare towards the rectory. However, he made himself extremely agreeable, which was with him more a matter of habit than those who occasionally profited by it would have cared to know. He asked young Thursby his opinion on E.C. cartridges. He condoled with Mrs. Thursby on the loss of her last butler, and recounted some alarming anecdotes of his own French cook. He admired a pallid watercolour drawing of Venice, in an enormous frame on an enormous easel, which he rightly supposed to be the manual labour of Mabel Thursby. When he rose to take his leave, young Thursby, intensely flattered by having been asked for that opinion on cartridges by so renowned a shot as Charles, offered to walk part of the way back with him. "I'm afraid I'm not going home yet," said Charles lightly. "Duty points in the opposite direction. I have to call at the rectory. I want Mr. Alwyn's opinion on a point of clerical etiquette, which is setting my young spiritual shepherd at Stoke Moulton against his principal sheep, namely, myself." Charles took his departure, leaving golden opinions behind him, and a determination to invite him once more to shoot, in spite of his many courteous refusals of the last few years. Mrs. Arwin always took a nap after luncheon in her smart Sunday gown, among the mustard-coloured cushions of her high-art sofa. Mr. Arwin also was apt at the same time to sink into a subdued, almost apologetic, doze, in the old armchair which alone had resisted the march of discomfort and so-called taste which had invaded the rest of the little drawing-room of Slumberly Rectory. Ruth was sitting with her dark head leaned against the open window-frame. Dare had not stayed after luncheon, being at times nervously afraid of giving her too much of his society, and she was at liberty to read over again, if she chose, the solitary letter which the Sunday Post had brought her. But she did not do so. She was thinking. And so her sister Anna was actually returning to England at last. She and her husband had taken a house in Rome, and had arranged that Ruth should join them in London in November, and go abroad with them after Christmas for the remainder of the winter. She had pleasant recollections of previous winters in Rome, or on the Riviera with her grandmother, and she was surprised that she did not feel more interested in the prospect. She supposed she would like it when the time came, but she seemed to care very little about it at the present moment. It had become very natural to live at Slumberly, and although there were drawbacks—here she glanced involuntarily at her aunt, who was making her slumbers vocal by a running commentary on them through her nose—still she would be sorry to go. Mr. Arwin gave the ghost of a miniature snore, and opening his eyes, found Ruth bent affectionately upon him. Her mind went back to another point in Anna's letter. After dilating on the extreme admiration and regard entertained for herself by her husband, his readiness with shawls, etc., she went on to ask whether Ruth had heard any news of Raymond. Ruth sighed. Would there ever be any news of Raymond? The old nurse at Arley always asked the same question. Any news of Master Raymond? It was with a tired ache of the heart that Ruth heard that question, and always gave the same answer. Once she had heard from him since Lady Dacourt's death, after she had written to tell him, as gently as she could, that she and Anna had inherited all their grandmother had to leave. A couple of months later she had received a hurried note in reply, inveighing against Lady Dacourt's injustice, saying, as usual, that he was hard up for money, and that, when he knew where it might safely be sent, he should expect her and her sister to make up to him for his disappointment. And since then, since April, not a word. June, July, August, September. 4 months, and no sign. When he was in want of money, his letters heretofore had made but little delay. Had he fallen ill and died out there, or met his death suddenly, perhaps in some wild adventure under an assumed name? Her lips tightened, and her white brows contracted over her absent eyes. It was an old anxiety, but none the less wearing because it was old. Ruth put it wearily from her, and took up the first book which came to her hand to distract her attention. It was a manual out of which Mrs. Arwin had been reading extracts to her in the morning, while Ruth had been engaged in preparing herself to teach in the Sunday school. She wondered vaguely how pleasure could be derived, even by the most religious persons, from seeing favourite texts twined in and out among phobic epinots, or falling aslant in old English letters off bunches of violets. But she was old enough and wise enough to know that one man's religion is another man's occasion of stumbling. Books are made to fit all minds, and small minds lose themselves in large-minded books. The thousands in which these little manuals are sold, and the confidence with which their readers recommend them to others, indicates the calibre of the average mind, and shows that they meet a want possibly not known before, but which they alone, with their little gilt edges, can adequately fill. Ruth was gazing in absent wonder at the volume which supplied all her aunt's spiritual needs, when she heard the wire of the front doorbell squeak faintly. It was a stiff-necked and obdurate bell, which for several years Mr. Arwin had determined to see about. A few moments later, James, the new and inexperienced footman, opened the door about half a foot, put in his head, murmured something inaudible, and withdrew it again. A tall figure appeared in the doorway and advanced to meet her, then stopped midway. Ruth rose hastily and stood where she had risen, her eyes glancing first at Mr. and then at Mrs. Arwin. The alien presence of a visitor had not disturbed them. Mrs. Arwin, her head well forward and a succession of chins undulating in perfect repose upon her chest, was sleeping as a stout person only can, all over. Mr. Alwyn opposite, his thin hands clasped listlessly over his knee, was as unconscious of the two pairs of eyes fixed upon him as Nelson himself laid out in Madame Tussaud's. Charles's eyes, twinkling with suppressed amusement, met Ruth's. He shook his head energetically as she made a slight movement as if to wake them, and stepping forward, pointed with his hat towards the open window which reached to the ground. Ruth understood, but she hesitated. At this moment Mrs. Alwyn began a variation on the simple theme on which she had been indulging, and in so much higher a key that all hesitation vanished. She stepped hastily out through the window, and Charles followed. They stood together for a moment in the blazing sunshine, both too much amused to speak. "You are bareheaded," he said now suddenly. "Is there any," looking round, "any shade we could take refuge under?" Ruth led the way round the yew hedge to the horse chestnut, that horse chestnut under which Dare had once lost his self-esteem. "I'm afraid," said Charles, "I arrived at an inopportune moment. As I was lunching with the Thursbys, I came up in the hope of finding Mr. Alwyn, whom I wanted to consult about a small matter in my own parish." Charles was quite pleased with this sentence when he had airily given it out. It had a true ring about it, he fancied, which he remembered with gratitude was more than the doorbell had. Peace be with that doorbell, and with the engaging youth who answered it. "I wish you'd let me wake Mr. Alwyn," said Ruth. "He will sleep on now till the bells begin." "On no account. I should have been shocked if you had disturbed him. I assure you I can easily wait until he naturally wakes up. That is," with a glance at the book in her hand, "if I am not disturbing you, if you are not engaged in improving yourself at this moment." "No, I have improved myself for the day, thanks. I can safely afford to relax a little now." "So can I. I resemble Lady Mary in that. On Sunday mornings she reflects on her own shortcomings. On Sunday afternoon she finds an innocent relaxation in pointing out mine." "Where is Lady Mary now?" "I should say she was in her bath chair on the Scarborough Sands at this moment." "I like her," said Ruth, with decision. "Tastes differ. Some people feel drawn towards wet blankets, and others have a leaning towards pokers. Do you know why you like her?" "I never thought about it, but I suppose it was because she seemed to like me." "Exactly. You admired her good taste. A very natural vanity, most pardonable in the young, was gratified at seeing marks of favour so well bestowed." "I dare say you are right. At any rate, you seem so familiar with the workings of vanity in the human breast that it would be a pity to contradict you." "By the way," said Charles, speaking in the way people do who have nothing to say, and trying to hit on any subject of conversation, "have you heard any more of your tramp? There was no news of him when I left. I asked the slumberly policeman about him again on my way to the station." "I have heard no more of him, though I keep the memory green. I have not forgotten the fright he gave me. I have always imagined I was rather a self-possessed person till that day." "I am a coward myself when I am frightened," said Charles, consolingly, "though at other times as bold as a lion." They were both sitting under the flickering shadow of the already yellowing horse chestnut tree, the first of all the trees to set the gorgeous autumn fashions. But as yet it was paling only at the edges of its slender fans. The air was sweet and soft, with a voiceless whisper of melancholy in it, as if the summer knew, in all her smiles, her hour had well nigh come. The rectory cows, the mottled one and the red one, and the big white one that was always milked first, came slowly past on their way to the pond, blinking their white eyelashes leisurely at Charles and Ruth. "It's almost as hot as that Sunday in July when we walked over from Atherston. Do you remember?" said Charles suddenly. "Yes." She knew he was thinking of their last conversation, and she felt a momentary surprise that he had remembered it. "We never finished that conversation," he said, after a pause. "No, but then conversations never are finished, are they? They always seem to break off just when they are coming to the beginning. A bell rings, or there is an interruption, or one is told it's bedtime." "Or fools rush in with their words where you and I should fear to tread, and spoil everything." "Yes." "And have you been holding the wool and tying up the flowers, as you so graphically described, ever since you left Atherston in July?"
I hope I have. I've tried.
I'm sure of that, he said with sudden earnestness, then added more slowly, I have not wound any wool. I have only enjoyed myself.
Perhaps, said Ruth, turning her clear, frank gaze upon him, that may have been the harder work of the two. It sometimes is.
His light, restless eyes, with the searching look in them which she had seen before, met hers, and then wandered away again to the level meadows and the woods and the faint sky.
I think it was, he said at last, and both were silent.
He reflected that his conversations with Ruth had a way of beginning in fun, becoming more serious, and ending in silence. The bells rang out suddenly. Charles thought they were full early.
Mr. Alwyn will wake up now, said Ruth. I will tell him you are here.
But before she had time to do more than rise from her chair, Mr. Alwyn came slowly round the yew hedge and stopped suddenly in front of the chestnut tree, amazed at what he saw beneath it. His mild eyes gazed blankly at Charles through his spectacles, gathering a pained expression as they peered over the top of them, which did not lessen when they fell on Ruth. Charles explained in a few words the purport of his visit, which had already explained itself quite sufficiently to Mr. Alwyn, and mentioning that he waited in the hope of presently finding Mr. Alwyn disengaged, at this Mr. Alwyn blushed a little, asked leave to walk as far as the church with him, to consult him on a small matter, etc. It was a neat sentence, but it did not sound quite so well the third time. It had lost by the heathenish and vain repetitions to which it had been subjected.
"Certainly, certainly," said Mr. Alwyn, mollified, but still discomposed. "You should have waked me, Ruth," turning reproachfully to his niece, whose conduct had never in his eyes fallen short of perfection till this moment. "Little nap after luncheon, hardly asleep, you should have waked me."
"There was Aunt Fanny," said Ruth, feeling as if she committed some grave sin.
"Aha," said Mr. Alwyn, as if her
reason were a weighty one, his memory possibly recalling the orchestral flourish which as a rule heralded his wife's return to consciousness.
"True, true, my dear. I must be going," as the chime ceased. "Are you coming to church this afternoon?"
Ruth replied that she was not. Mr. Alwyn and Charles departed together, Charles ruefully remembering that he had still to ask advice on a subject the triviality of which would hardly allow of two opinions. Ruth watched them walk away together, and then went back noiselessly into the drawing-room. Mrs. Alwyn was sitting bolt upright, her feet upon the floor, her gown upon the sofa. Her astonished eyes were fixed upon the dwindling figures of Mr. Alwyn and Charles.
"Goodness, Ruth," she explained, "who is that white-whiskered walking with your uncle?"
Ruth explained.
"Dear me, and as likely as not he came to see the new screen. I know Mrs. Thursby tells everybody about it, and his own house so full of beautiful things, too. Was ever anything so annoying? We should have had so much in common, for I hear his taste is quite, well, really quite out of the way. How contrary things are, Ruth! You awake and me asleep, when it might just as well have been the other way. But it is Sunday, my dear, so we must not complain. And now, as we have missed church, I will lie down again, and you shall read me that nice sermon, which I always like to hear when I can't go to church. The one in the green book about Nabob's vineyard."
End of chapter 14. Chapter 15 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 15. Great philosophers and profound metaphysicians should by rights have lived at Snumberley. Those whose lines have fallen to them 10 miles from a lemon have time to think, if so inclined. Only elementary natures complain of their surroundings, and though at first Ruth had been impatient and depressed, after a time she found that, better than to live in an atmosphere of thought, was to be thrown entirely on her own resources, and to do her thinking for herself. Some minds, of course, sink into inanition if an outward supply of nutriment is withheld. Others get up and begin to forage for themselves. Happy are these, when the transition period is over, when, after a time, the first and worst mistakes have been made and suffered for, and the only teaching that profits anything at all, the bitter teaching of experience, has been laid to heart. Such a nature was Ruth's, upright, self-reliant, without the impetuosity and impulsiveness that so often accompanies an independent nature, but accustomed to look at everything through her own eyes, and to think, but not till now, to act for herself.
She had been brought up by her grandmother to believe that before all things, noblesse oblige, to despise a dishonourable action, to have her feelings entirely under control, to be intimate with few, to be courteous to all. But to help others, to give up anything for them, to love an unfashionable or middle-class neighbour, or to feel a personal interest in religion, except as a subject of conversation, had never found a place in Lady Dacre's code, or, consequently, in Ruth's, though, as was natural with a generous nature, the girl did many little kindnesses to those about her, and was personally unselfish, as those who live with self-centred people are bound to be, if there is to be any semblance of peace in the house. But now, new thoughts were stirring within her, were leavening her whole mind. All through these monotonous months she had watched the quiet routine of patient effort that went to make up the sum of Mr. Alwyn's life. He was a shy man. He seldom spoke of religion out of the pulpit. But all through these long months he preached it without words to Ruth, as she had never heard it preached before, by the best portion of a good man's life, his little nameless unremembered acts of kindness and of love. It was the first time that she had come into close contact with a life spent for others, and its beauty appealed to her with a new force, and gradually, but surely, changed the current of her thoughts, until, as we needs must love the highest when we see it, she unconsciously fell in love with self-sacrifice. The opinions of most young persons, however loudly and injudiciously proclaimed, rarely do the possessors much harm, because they are not, as a rule, acted upon. But with some few people, a change of views means a change of life. Ruth was on the edge of a greater change than she knew. At first she had often regretted the chapter of her life that had been closed by Lady Dacre's death. Now she felt she could not go back to it, and find it all-sufficient as of old. It would need an added element, without which she began to see that any sort or condition of life is but a stony, dusty concern after all, an element which made even Mr. Alwyn's colourless existence a contented and happy one. Ruth had been telling him one day, as they were walking together, of her sister's plans for the winter, and that she was sorry to think her time at Slumberley was drawing to a close. "I am afraid," he said, "in spite of all you say, my dear, it has been very dull for you here. No little gaieties or enjoyments, such as it is right young people should have. I wish we'd had a picnic, or a garden party, or something. Mabel Thursby cannot be happy without these things, and it is natural at your age that you should wish for them. Your aunt and I lead very quiet lives. It suits us, but it is different for young people." "Does it suit you?" asked Ruth, with sudden earnestness. "Do you really like it, or do you sometimes get tired of it?" Mr. Alwyn looked a little alarmed and disconcerted. He never cared to talk about himself. "I used to get tired," he said at last, with reluctance, "when I was younger. There were times when I foolishly expected more from life than in fact I quite got, my dear, and the result was, I fear, I had a very discontented spirit, an unthankful discontented spirit," he repeated, with sad retrospection. Something in his tone touched Ruth to the quick. "And now?" "I am content now." "Uncle John, tell me, how did you grow to feel content?" He saw there were tears in her eyes. "It took a long time," he said. "Anything that is worth knowing, Ruth, takes a long time to learn. I think I find in the end, my dear, that the only way was to put my whole heart into what I was doing." Mr. Alwyn's voice was simple and earnest, as if he were importing to Ruth a great discovery. "I have tried before, from time to time, of course, but never quite as hard as I might have done. That was where I failed. When I put myself on one side and really settled down to what I could for others, life became much simpler and happier." He turned his grave, patient eyes to Ruth's again. Was something troubling her? "I have often thought since then," he went on, speaking more to himself than to her, "that we should consider well what we are keeping back our strength for, if we find ourselves refusing to put the whole of it into our work. When at last one does start, one feels it is such a pity one did not do it earlier in life. When I look at all the young faces growing up around me, I often hope, Ruth, they won't waste as much time as I did." How simple it seemed while she listened to him. How easy, how natural, this life for others. She could not answer. One sentence of Mr. Alwyn's was knocking at the door of her heart for admission.
was drowning with its loud beating the sound of all the rest. We should consider well what we are keeping back our strength for, if we refuse to put the whole of it into our work. She and Mr. Alwyn walked on in silence, and after a time, always afraid of speaking much on the subject that was first in his own mind, he began to talk again on trivial matters, to tell her how he had met Dare that morning, and had promised on her behalf that she would sing at a little local concert which the Vanden schoolmaster was getting up that week, to defray the annual expense of the Vanden Cricket Club, and in which Dare was taking a vivid interest. "You won't mind singing, will you, Ruth?" asked Mr. Alwyn, wishing she would show a little more interest in Dare and his concert.
"Oh, no, of course not," rather hurriedly. "I should be glad to help in any way."
"And I thought, my dear, as it would be getting late, we'd better accept his offer of staying the night at Vanden." Ruth assented, but so absently that Mr. Alwyn dropped the subject with a sigh, and walked on, revolving weighty matters in his mind. They left the woods now, and were crossing the field, where, 2 months ago, the school feast had been held. Mr. Alwyn made some slight allusion to it, and then coughed. Ruth's attention, which had been distracted, came back in a moment. She knew her uncle had something which he did not like, something which yet he felt it his duty to say, when he gave that particular cough. "That was when you were staying with the Danvers, wasn't it, Ruth?" in a would-be casual, disengaged tone. "Yes, I came over from Atherston with Molly Danvers."
"I remember," said Mr. Alwyn, looking extremely uncomfortable, "and, if I am not mistaken, Sir Charles Danvers was staying there at the same time?"
"Certainly he was."
"Yes, and I dare say, Ruth, I'm not finding fault, far from it. I dare say he made himself very agreeable for the time being."
"I don't think he made himself so. I should have said he was naturally so, without any effort, just as some people are naturally the reverse."
"Indeed. Well, I've always heard he was most agreeable, but I'm afraid, I think perhaps it's just as well you should know, forewarned is forearmed, you know, that in fact he says a great deal more than he means sometimes."
"Does he?"
"I dare say he does. He has a habit of appearing to take a great interest in people, which I'm afraid means very little. I dare say he is not fully aware of it, or I'm sure he would struggle against it, and we must not judge him. But still, his manner does a great deal of harm. It is peculiarly open to misconstruction. For instance," continued Mr. Alwyn, making a rush as his courage began to fail him, "it struck me, Ruth, the other day, Sunday, was it? Yes, I think it was Sunday, that really he had not much to ask me about his weekday services. I think he need not have called."
"I dare say not.
But now, that is just the kind of thing he does. Calls and under chestnut trees and that sort of thing. And how are young people to know unless their elders tell them that it is only his way, that he has done just the same ever so often before?"
"And will again," said Ruth, trying to keep down a smile. "Is it true, Mabel is full of it, that he is engaged, or on the point of being so, to one of Lord Hope Acton's daughters?"
"People are always saying he is engaged to first one person and then another," said Mr. Alwyn, breathing more freely now that his duty was discharged. "It often grieves me that your aunt mentions his engagement so confidently to friends, because it gives people the impression that we know, and we really don't. He's a great deal talked about because he is such a conspicuous man in the county, on account of his wealth and his place and the odd things he says and does. There is something about him that is different from other people. I'm sure I don't know why it is, but I like him very much myself. I've known him do such kind things. Dear me, what a pleasant week I had at Stoke Moreton last year. It is beautiful, Ruth, and the collection of old papers and manuscripts unique. Your aunt was in Devonshire with friends at the time. I wish he would ask me again this autumn to see those charters of Edward IV's reign that have been found in the secret drawer of an old cabinet. I hear they are quite small and have green seals. I wish I had thought of asking him about them on Sunday. If they are really small, but it was only Archdeacon Egbton who told me about them, and he never sees anything any particular size. If they should happen to be really small—" Mr. Alwyn turned eagerly to the all-engrossing subject of the Stoke Moreton charters, which furnished him with conversation till they reached home. "We should consider well what we are keeping back our strength for, if we refuse to put the whole of it into our work." All through the afternoon and the quiet, monotonous evening, these words followed Ruth.
She read them between the lines of the book she took up. She stitched them into her sewing. They went upstairs with her at night. They followed her into her room, and would not be denied. When she'd sent away her maid, she sat down by the window, and with the full harvest moon for company, faced them, and asked them what they meant. But they only repeated themselves over and over again. What had they to do with her? Her mind tried to grip with them in vain. And often as she came to close quarters with them, they eluded her and disappeared, only to return with the old formula. Her thoughts drifted away at last to what Mr. Alwyn had said of Charles, and all the disagreeable things which Mabel had come up on Monday morning, with a bunch of late roses, on purpose to tell her respecting him. She had taken Mabel's information at its true worth, which I fear was but small. But she felt annoyed that both Mabel and Mr. Alwyn should have thought it necessary to warn her. As if, she said to herself, she had not known. Really, she had not been born and bred in Slumberley, nor had she lived there all her life. She had met men of that kind before. She always liked them. Charles especially amused her, and she could see that she amused him. And now she came to think of it, she supposed he had paid her a good deal of attention at Atherston, and perhaps he had not come over to Slumberley especially to see Mr. Alwyn. It was as natural to men like Charles to be always interested in someone, as it would be unnatural in others ever to be so, except as a result of long forethought, and with a wedding ring and a set of bridesmaids well in view. But to attach any importance to the fact that Charles liked to talk to her would have been absurd. With another man it might have meant much. But she'd heard of Charles and his misdoings long before she had met him, and knew what to expect. Lord Breakwater's sister had confided to her many things respecting him, and had wept bitter tears on her shoulder when he suddenly went off to shoot grizzlies in the Rocky Mountains. "He has not sufficient vanity to know that he is exceedingly popular," said Ruth to herself. "I do think there are few men, handicapped as he is, who have been liked more entirely for themselves, and less for their belongings. But all the time he probably imagines people admire his name, or his place, or his income, and not himself, and consequently he does not care much what he says or does. I'm certain he does not mean to do any harm. His manner never deceived me for a moment. I can't see why it should others. But from all accounts he seems to be frequently misunderstood. That is just the right word for him. He is misunderstood. At any rate, I never misunderstood him. That Sunday call might have made me suspicious of any ordinary mortal, but I knew no common rule could apply to such an exception as he is. I only wonder, when he really does find himself in earnest, how he is to convey his meaning to the future Lady Danvers. What words would be strong enough, what ink would be black enough, to carry conviction to her mind? She smiled at the thought, and as she smiled, another face rose suddenly before her. Dare's, pale and serious, as it had been of late, with the wistful, anxious eyes. He, at least, had meant a great deal, she thought with remorse. He had been in earnest, sufficiently in earnest to make himself very unhappy, and on her account. Ruth had known for some time that Dare loved her, but tonight that simple, unobtrusive fact suddenly took larger proportions, came boldly out of the shadows, and looked her in the face. He loved her. Well, what then? She turned giddy and leaned her head against the opened shutter. In the silence, the words that had haunted her all the afternoon came back, not loud as heretofore, but in a whisper, speaking to her heart, which had begun to beat fast and loud. We should consider well what we are keeping back our strength for, if we refuse to put the whole of it into our work. What work was there for her to do? The giddiness and the whirl in her mind died down suddenly like a great gust on the surface of a lake, and left it still and clear and cold. The misery of the world and the inability to meet it had so often confused and weighed her down, that she had come back humbly of late to the only possibility with which it was in her power to deal, come back to the well-worn groove of earnest determination to do as much as in her lay close at hand, when she could find a field to labour in. And now she suddenly saw, or thought she saw, that she had found it. She had been very anxious to whether Dare would do his duty, but till this moment it had never struck her that it might be her duty to help him. She liked him, and he was poor, too poor to do much for the people who were dependent on him, the poor, struggling people of Vanden. Their sullen, miserable faces rose up before her, and their crazy houses. Fever had broken out again in the cottages by the river. He needed help and encouragement, for he had a difficult time before him. And she had these to give, and money too. Could she do better with them? She knew Mr. Alwyn wished it. And as to herself, was she never going to put self on one side? She never liked anyone very much, at least not in that way. But she liked him. The words came like a loud voice in the silence. She liked him. Well, what then? She shut her eyes, but she only shut out the moon's pale photographs of the fields and woods. She could not shut out these stern, besieging thoughts. What was she holding back for? For some possibly ideal romantic future? For the prince of a fairy story? No. Well, then for what? The moon went behind a cloud and took all her photographs with her. The night had turned very cold. "Tomorrow," said Ruth to herself, rising slowly. "I'm too tired to think now. Tomorrow." And as she spoke, the faint chime of the clock upon her table warned her that already it was tomorrow. And soon, in a moment, as it seemed to her, before she had had time to think, it was again tomorrow, a wet, dim tomorrow, and she was at Vanden, running up the wide stone steps in the starlight under Dare's protecting umbrella, and allowing him to take her wraps from her before the hall fire. The concert had gone off well. Ruth was pleased, Mr. Alwyn was pleased. Dare was in a state of repressed excitement, now flying into the drawing-room to see if there were a good fire, as it was a chilly evening, now rushing thence to the dining-room to satisfy himself that all the immense and elaborate preparations which he had enjoined on the cook had been made. Then Ruth must be shown to her room. Who was to do it? He flew to find the housekeeper, and after repeated injunctions to the housemaid, whom he met in the passage, not to forget the hot water, took Mr. Alwyn off to his apartment. The concert had begun, as concerts always seem to do, at the exact time at which it is usual to dine, so that it was late before the principal performers and Mr. Alwyn reached Vanden. It was later still before supper came, but when it came, it was splendid. Dare looked with anxious satisfaction over a soup tureen, the various spiced and glazed forms of indigestion, sufficient for a dozen people, which covered the table. It grieved him that Ruth, confronted by a spreading ham, and Mr. Alwyn, half hidden by a boulder of turkey, should have such moderate appetites. But at least she was there, under his roof, at his table. It was not surprising that he could eat nothing himself. After supper, Mr. Alwyn, who combined the wisdom of the worldly serpent with the harmlessness of the clerical dove, fell, not too suddenly, asleep by the fire in the drawing-room, and Ruth and Dare went into the hall where the piano was. Dare opened it and struck a few minor chords. Ruth sat down in a great carved armchair beside the fire. The hall was only lighted by a few tall lamps high on pedestals against the walls, which threw great profiles of the various busts upon the dim bas-reliefs of twining scrollwork, and Dare, with his eyes fixed on Ruth, began to play. There is in some music a strange appeal beyond the reach of words. Those mysterious sharps and flats and major and minor chords are an alphabet that in some occult combinations forms another higher language than that of speech, a language which, as we listen, thrills us to the heart. It was an old piano, with an impediment in its speech, out of the yellow notes of which Ruth could have made nothing. But in Dare's hands it spoke for him as he never could have spoken for himself. His eyes never left her. He feared to look away, lest he should find the presence of that quiet, graceful figure by his fireside had been a dream, and that he was alone again with the dim lamps, alone with Dante and Cicero and Seneca. The firelight dwelt ruddily upon her grave, clear-cut face and level brows, and upon the folds of her white gown. It touched the slender hands clasped lightly together on her knee, and drew sudden sparks and gleams out of the diamond pin at her throat. His hands trembled on the keys, and as he looked his heart beat high and higher, loud and louder, till it drowned the rhythm of the music. And as he looked, her calm eyes met his. In another moment he was on his knees beside her, her hands caught in his trembling clasp, and his head pressed down upon them. "I know," he gasped, "it's no good. You've told me so once. You will tell me so again. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. But I love you. I love you." In moments of real feeling,
The old words hold their own against all modern newcomers. Dare repeated them over and over again in a paroxysm of overwhelming emotion which shook him from head to foot. Something in his boyish attitude and in his entire loss of self-control touched Ruth strangely. She knew he was 5 or 6 years her senior, but at the moment she felt as if she were much older than he, and a sudden vague wish passed through her mind that he'd be nearer her in age, not quite so young. "Well," she said gently, and he felt her cool, passive hands tremble a little in his. Something in the tone of her voice made him raise his head and meet her eyes, looking down at him, earnestly, and with a great kindness in them. A sudden, eager light leaped into his face.
"Will you?"
he whispered breathlessly, his hands tightening their hold of hers.
"Will you?"
There was a moment's pause, in which the whole world seemed to stand quite still and wait for her answer. "Yes," she said at last,
"I will."
"I'm glad I did it," she said to herself half an hour later, as she leaned her tired head against the carved oak chimney-piece in her bedroom and absently traced with her finger the Latin inscription over the fireplace. "I like him very much. I'm glad I did it." End of chapter 15.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters' 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.